Welcome to What the World Needs Now with hosts Tom Wisenand and Josh Monroe. We hope you're able to leave feeling encouraged and ready for another day of changing lives in the field of education as we speak with inspirational teachers from across the nation and world about what keeps their spark lit.
In this episode, Jamie Cassop, Google's former educational evangelist, shares his passion about educational equality and where education is heading in the future. Without any further ado, Jamie Cassop.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We're excited to have you and get to talk with you. And for our listeners that don't know who you are, could you just give us a little bit about who you are, kind of an elevator pitch?
Yeah, so we were talking about names before this. It's Jamie Cassop or Jaime Cassop, depending on what language you speak. I was the chief education evangelist at Google for almost 15 years. I was there. Back in 2006 was when I started, got into the education space a little bit by mistake when I partnered with ASU to launch what we used to call Google Apps, that we now call G Suite, into the higher education space. Launched Google Apps into higher education, started falling in love with the idea of what we could do with technology in education. A couple years later, I had this crazy idea of launching Google Apps into K-12. And we signed the state of Oregon. That's the partner I partnered with, is the state of Oregon, who said that any school district in Oregon could use G Suite, Google Apps, in their school. And 28 school districts signed up on the first day. But the craziest idea I had was launching Chromebooks into education when Chromebooks were not meant for education. They were meant for the business world. They were meant for consumers. And I just, you know, when I saw what it could do, even at its limited capability, you know, back in 2011, I thought we could do a lot with that kind of technology, especially for end users who, you know, needed fast machines, who needed things that just boot up instantly, and administrators who manage thousands of machines at the same time. And literally me and another person, Dana, got on the road for 6 months and with our Pelican cases, and we went to different offices and pitched the idea of Chromebooks, and eventually a couple school districts said, yeah, we'll try that. And you know, that was all in the middle of the iPad revolution that was going on. And then I've done some other things at Google. If you go to the website and you go to the Google for Education Transformation Center, I created that model, and that's based on this idea that it's not technology that changes education or transforms education or improves education, whatever word you want to use. It's all the things together, right? It's leadership, it's culture, it's, you know, your internal systems, it's technology, it's funding, it's all these things working together. So I recently left. I left in June because the best time to leave work is in the middle of a pandemic. And I'm focused on taking some of the things that I've learned and working with companies that are doing things in the education space, working with higher education institutions on some of the things that they want to do around equity and access, and then working with school districts as well, and a couple of businesses that I can't talk about yet. But, you know, I'm kind of all over the place trying, like I said in my video, it's not one thing. I'm trying to do like 10 different things.
It's absolutely incredible what you do, and how your idea of equity with these Google Chromebooks really like took off and really changed the education space and everything. That was incredible. For those people who may not be familiar, tell us a little bit about your background, how you grew up, where you grew up, sure. If you would, please.
Yeah, no, a lot of it has to, you know, look, I think one of the things, I grew up, I was born and raised in Hell's Kitchen, New York, back in the 70s and 80s, when it really deserved that name. I grew up with a single mother. I grew up on welfare and food stamps, and, you know, in a very violent community. And the reason I get to talk to you guys is because of education. So I don't know that many more advocates for education than me. And there's two things about that. Number one is I didn't start talking about this in my background until much later in my life. And when I talk to students who are growing up like I grew up, I tell them that that was a mistake, that, you know, who they are and where they come from, that they should own it, that they should live in it, because it's their competitive advantage. Like, I think one of the reasons why I end up being the most unique voice in a room is because of my background, because of my perspective and the things that I learned in my life. And so own it, that's one. And then the second thing, and this is more around the problem that I'm trying to solve now, which is to prove one of these two assumptions, right? Assumption number one is I get to talk to you guys and I've had this influence and this power and I've had these roles and I've been successful because I'm a super genius with a 900 IQ, right? That's assumption number one. That's what my wife thinks, I think. Or assumption number two is that there are millions of students who are just like me. And what we need to do is give them the opportunity to thrive and give them the opportunity to show their competency and their capabilities. And that's the problem I'm trying to solve.
And I love that you talk about telling students to tell their story, where they came from, because that helps make us who we are. That's sure. part of
So it's an important point because most people can talk about the background. And so you have to ask yourself, you know, trying to dig into the root cause, like why students don't do that? And part of it is consciously and mostly subconsciously, students at a very young age learn through society that society equates poverty with negative things. You're poor because your family's lazy. You're poor because you're dumb. You're poor because you didn't take an, you know, it's this whole idea of like, you didn't pull your family didn't pull itself up by its bootstraps, right? And so what students do is they end up hiding that. They don't want people to know that. And I did the same thing for years. And so it becomes this thing that is a stigma. So you don't want to talk about it because it's hard enough, for example, to be a student of color. You don't want to add to that that you were also poor because, oh, this guy, he didn't probably didn't go to a good school or he probably didn't get good grades or his family must have like been a terrible family. So they tend to block that out.
You know, Jamie, I teach at a fairly well-to-do school, and there are not a lot of kids in poverty at the school I teach in. And so I was really curious about this book that you wrote. And I thought that it was an absolute wonderful way to maybe introduce students who may not be around poverty, may not have the knowledge of poverty, to some reasons like you were talking about, not stereotypical reasons, but actual the whys. People may grow up in poverty and what it is and how, what we can do to help. So it's on our street. First talk about poverty and good work on that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, the child psychologist who wrote that book with me approached me on this idea. She had another series of books and she heard me at some conference and approached me, emailed me and said, let's write this book together because I want your perspective. So I wrote a lot of it, but the concept of this idea of poverty is we don't talk to students about poverty, right? We don't talk to them about if, so what happens is they fill those gaps with their own assumptions. And a lot of times those assumptions come from their families. And sometimes their families' assumptions come from their families and it just goes down as opposed to diving into the root cause. So you pull up on a highway, exit and you see a person begging for money and that student might have heard his father or mother say, hey, you know, in their head or even out loud or in the car, you know, get a job. And so the kid's like, oh, that person's poor because they don't want to work and they're begging for money as opposed to like that person might have mental issues, right?
Yeah.
Or that person might be sick or something happened in their lives that caused them to do that, right? And so I think it's important to have these conversations about where poverty comes from and then get real, right? When we talk about diversity and we talk about equity and inclusion and these things, we have to understand that it's not just the conditions that cause poverty, that we created systems on purpose to cause poverty. Like we just got to deal with that, right? And so those things are out there and we're not going to change anything unless we go and deal with those systems. So at the individual level, it could be a mental issue. It could be a financial issue. It could be an immigrant issue. It could be lots of issues as to why you're poor, but we also have to recognize that we set up these systems and that equity in education is a great example. For example, the fact that school districts are funded by property tax and zip codes, right? Like that's a system that has been set up. Now, was it set up to discriminate and be a racist system? that's a question that I don't really care what the answer is. It is, though. And so let's fix it, right? And so we got to fix systematic things. Like, so for example, you know, the phrase, I've been ranting a lot lately about this idea of preparing kids for college and career, right? That's a big phrase that we use in K-12, right? Preparing kids for college and career. And I have been thinking lately, why are we shooting so low, right? Like, why is getting a job the best we can do? And especially for our kids that are growing up in these vulnerable communities, like getting every, you know, black and brown kid in a poor community a job might have an economic impact, but it's not gonna change anything, right? What we need are entrepreneurs and wealth and scientists and researchers and policymakers and, you know, inventors, like that's what we should be shooting for. And if they don't do that and end up getting a job, that's great, but at least we could be shooting higher than that. And so these are the systematic things that we have to do. And we're too focused on what we need to do for poor people is get them jobs. When in reality is we need to change the systems and create equitable systems so that they can thrive just like anyone else has a chance to.
That's awesome. I teach at a Title I school. And so a lot of the kids that come to our school do come from poverty. And I'm excited to be able to put your book on our bookshelf and for them to have a chance to read and learn about poverty. And I can tell that you're super passionate about education. How'd you develop that passion? Because it sounded like when you were talking it, you said it was kind of an accident in Google.
Right. Well, so it's funny because I actually had been a college professor before I got a job at Google, right? So teaching is something that's always come natural to me, and I love to teach. And I was in the dining room tonight having dinner, talking to my six-year-old about the three branches of government. And I have a way of doing it where it makes sense to her, right? And like, what's a protest, right? Like she's like, what's a protest? And I try to break it down to her level, right? And so the example I gave her was like, imagine they passed a law that said all dogs were illegal and we had to get rid of dogs, right? And so we have three dogs, so she can understand that and get into it and be like, no, wouldn't you be mad about that? Yeah, like, well, we have the right to go and protest and have our voices heard, but we don't have a right to go break down buildings or start fires or do anything like that. So I've always loved to teach. You know, I teach my kids, and I've taught in K-12. I've taught in high school a couple of classes on communication. So I've always had a passion for teaching. I think that I would have, if pushed down that path, I would have, you know, I was a professor for 14 years. I think I would have kept going in that direction. But I think for me, the big passion comes from this idea that I believe anyone can learn anything that they want. And I think that the technology that we have is incredible, and we're not taking advantage of it the way we can take advantage of it. Like I watched this weekend, I watched the Social Dilemma thing on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I ranted like 17 times through that whole thing, right? Because there's so many missed opportunities when someone says, what we need to do is ban technology. Like, that's not what the issue is, right? Like the issue isn't technology. Technology, like anything else, can be used for good or bad. And so what we need to do, and one of the things I ranted about the most, is to be able to teach our students how to use technology. And we kind of skipped that step, right? We kind of gave them a pass. We told them that they're digital natives. We told them that they're just born with technology and they naturally know how to use it, and they don't. And so we have to go back and teach them. So all my passion comes from this idea that you can learn anything you want. So, you know, this is on YouTube, but when I started my YouTube channel a year and a half ago, I'm starting it back up next week, as a matter of fact. But when I started my YouTube channel, I knew nothing about film. I knew nothing about videography. I knew nothing about editing. I've always been a photographer. If you go to my Instagram account, you'll see my photography. But if I didn't even know my camera, I've always had a good camera, but I never knew that it had a record button on it. And so I went to my first daughter, who actually works in film and editing. And I said, where do I start? Where do I need to learn? And she said, shooting 1080, shooting, you don't need to shoot in 4K. You know, make sure your frame rate is double your shutter speed, and your shutter speed is double your frame rate. So shooting 24 frames a second and make sure your shutter rate's at 50. And I said, thank you very much for all that information. My next question is, what the hell do any of those words mean, right? And you zero. And then I went and learned. And now I can have debates about whether you should shoot in 4.42 or 4.20 and why the difference and what's better, the Sony A7R4 or the new Canon R5? And I can tell you why one is that better than the other, right? And that all happened in a year and a half. So my passion comes from this idea that it's like as close as we've been to the Matrix, right? Where we can literally plug a thing in our head and learn anything that we want, and we're not taking advantage of it.
Yeah, that's incredible. Because we have everything at our fingertips.
Yeah.
Everything. Any fact, any bit of information.
Sure.
Oh, right there. Gosh, you've been around technology and education for your life. What this pandemic has really done some weird things with education. What is your take on where education was and what has this pandemic done? And then where are we going to come out on on the other end? You know, we're looking at vaccines and everything ending this pandemic. What has education done with this pandemic?
And this is going to be weird to say, but I think the pandemic is the best thing that's ever happened to education, right? Mm. I get up on stages and I talk at conferences. And one of the things that I say that kind of shocks people, especially the people on my side of the coin, I say education is not broken, right? Mm. There's nothing broken in education. Education, actually, if you actually dig into the numbers, education is the best it's ever been. Graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in this country. The content that we teach is better than it's ever been. It's stronger than, like, I had to stop helping my kids with their homework in fifth grade because it got too hard for me, right? Like the problem isn't education. The problem is that education is doing exactly what it was designed to do. The problem is that the world has rapidly changed since 1994. And what we have to do is what our forefathers in education did when the Industrial Revolution started, is ask ourselves, what is the right model for this future? And then build a system around that and take the best ideas and the best lessons and everything that we've learned about education and apply that to this new model that we need. So it's not that education is broken, it's doing exactly what it was designed to do. And so those design principles are things that I think are breaking apart, which I don't think would have happened without the pandemic. For example, you can't really give kids homework when they're already home, right? Like that. And so all of a sudden homework goes away. And I'm a big advocate for getting rid of homework for lots of reasons. There's equity issues, but you know, my kids had access to literally space rocket engineers, right? And so how is that fair if I can get my kid to contact a space rocket engineer and you can't, right? When you're trying to do some research on something. So there's an equity issue involved, but more, even if everything was a fair across the board, we spend, I don't know, $1 trillion on life work balance things and how to be stress-free and how to detach yourself from work, when we could be teaching kids that starting in kindergarten. There's work and then there's your life. And when you're done with work, then you go to your life. And we could be doing that now, right? We can stop that now. That's homework for me. That's something that's breaking apart. Assessments. I don't believe in the assessments that we currently use. I believe in assessing someone. I don't believe in the model that we have. And it's interesting because during the pandemic, educators or policymakers, or it was usually test people who make tests, were talking about how students were falling behind. They lost a year of learning. They've fallen behind. And you know, my rant this year has been like, fall behind in what? What are they falling behind in? You're either learning or you're not learning. The only thing they fall in behind in is that they are not ready to take the test that you set up. That's your problem. That's not my problem, right? And so I think you're starting to see delays on assessments. And so I think we have an opportunity to really assess what's important based on this idea of the system that we need to create for the future. Because, you know, I often talk about this whole idea of digitalization, and we talk about how everything is moving in that direction. And we have to ask ourselves, or tell ourselves, that if we're helping our students prepare for tasks, for jobs that machines can do better, we're preparing them for failure. And what we need to do is double down on what I call human skills, right? Problem solving, critical thinking, collaboration, the ability to learn, creativity. Those things are the most important things. Those things are not going to be impacted by technology or digitalization. Those things are going to help. And it's not this, you know, we are in this battle, humans versus machines, like we're in the Matrix or something. And it's not that. It's humans and machines cooperating and working together to solve problems. Just like you, we're having a human experience through technology. And so we can double down on these things. And so one of the things that I'm hoping that we do in education is start measuring. How do you measure problem solving skills? How do you measure critical thinking? If all of a sudden we don't have to take those standardized tests anymore and we can start assessing what really matters, that's an opportunity. And so I see some of those things happening. I don't think we're going to go back to normal in anything, right? Like, I don't think we're going back to normal in work. I don't think we're going to go back to normal in school. I think we have different ideas of what's a priority and what learning looks like. I think there's an appreciation for teachers that we've never had before by the general public, right? I have a friend who's a high school teacher, and she was in a supermarket and she was wearing like a high school coaching jacket or something, and somebody walked by her and like whispered in her ear, "Thank you for your service," right? Like they're in the military, right? So I think that all those things are going to be factors in what education looks like in the future.
I want to ask you about the equity piece. Just because you said that the pandemic could be the best thing that's happened in education, so I just want to get your opinion on this, because where we live in Omaha, our district's 1-to-1. So our kids, in essence, had access to online learning. Now, there was, of course, houses that didn't have Wi-Fi and didn't have internet access. But then there was the district across the street from us, and their students didn't have any access to devices. So how do you think that's going to affect education going forward too? Because that's a huge equity piece that we're...
So I think that the pandemic has put a light on that, right? We've shown a light on that issue. Those of us who have been in the equity and access space for the last 10 years, talking about how access is an issue, have been talking about it for a long time. And yet schools continue to send homework with online resources, and kids are sitting in McDonald's and doing their work because they don't have internet access at home. Like, this is something we've been talking about for 10 years. And now the pandemic has put a big spotlight on what that issue is, and we have to deal with it, to the point where even the president of the United States at some point in this last 8 months said, we really need to focus on broadband in America. Like that's how much of a shift we'll see. So I think, I hope that it's a temporary solution. I hope that we understand that having access to technology and the internet is like having access to electricity, and that we take it that seriously. And I think that you're starting to see that across many territories, where you see that access to the internet's important, and we've put a spotlight on what the issues are when it comes to access to technology, to the internet, and what that looks like. So I'm hopeful that this is a temporary problem.
Yeah, I think what you said is absolutely right. It's as integral to light living as electricity or water even, as we move forward. You talked a little bit about leaving Google, and you're involved in a bunch of new ventures. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit about Indigo Education and what you're doing there and how that all fits into equity and the skills that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. So what's interesting about, I've been working with Indigo for a couple of years, and why I started working with them is for a couple of reasons. We've all done our assessments, strengths finders and what's the other one? Myers-Briggs. Like, we've all done those things. and I did the Indigo one. Yes, the questionnaire that they had. Mm-hmm. And when I got back my results, I gave them to my wife, who's known me for 12 years. And she read it and like, this is you. This is the most accurate any of these things have been, right? And so I'm like, oh, cool. Now what can we do with this? Mm-hmm. And I think what's important about doing those kinds of assessments isn't so much that it's two things. One, it's an opportunity for students to know who they are and what their strengths are. Like, I wish I would have done an assessment like that as a freshman in high school so that I know that I am not a detailed oriented person, that there's nothing wrong with not knowing how to use Excel, that I'm just not very good at it, right? That I'm just never gonna remember the little details. I'm just not that person. And knowing those things early on in your career or in your life can help you point into different kinds of roles and jobs that you're looking for. So students getting to know themselves is important. So that's one. And so the school that I helped start here in Phoenix, the Phoenix Coding Academy, we ran that assessment with all freshman students. That's awesome. And the second thing that it does is that it puts you in a category. At its simplest level, are you a big thinker or are you a detail person? Where do you thrive? Do you get energy from details or from big picture things? And so when you do an assessment and an educator can see that's the basic level, right? Whether it's a big thinker or a detail person, when you're starting to do real collaboration, right? You're not doing the 1, 2, 3, 4 count. You're actually being purposeful about setting up teams. You're being mindful about the teams that you set up because you can look at everyone's assessment and be like, well, we can't put 4 detailed oriented people on a team together. They're not gonna work. Can't put 4 big thinkers in a room or in a team because that's not gonna work. So it helps teachers and educators set up real collaboration by putting complementary skills together, which is what a good team should look like.
That's awesome, because that would be a game changer when you're getting ready to put students in groups to complete the project, and right. It's the second, third week of school, and you don't really know them yet.
You don't know who they are, right? And so with that assessment, you can do a lot of that work. And also, we have to, you know, like I often talk about how, you know, we talk about collaboration in education, but we don't mean it, because most of the work we do is group work, right? It's, you get one paper, you know, you tell 4 students, you guys are going to be responsible for a paper, go do it. And then one kid writes it and the other 3 pay that kid, right? Like that's how I got beer money in college, right? I wrote people's papers for fun. I'm like, what are you writing on? You know, they would say like the impact of the UN in Latin American politics. I'm like, oh, I want to write that. And so okay. I would just go write that paper, right? So I think that we have to understand that real collaboration is when you put pieces together of a team where one piece couldn't live without the other piece, right? So that gives us an opportunity to do individual assessments and a group assessment because people, you know, students have to work together. So the projects that we need to come up with are projects that need different skill sets, and then put those skill sets together or have students identify which part of it they're going to do or where their strengths are, and then go do that. And so that's a little bit different. And you can't do that unless you know your team. And if you don't know your team 2, 3 weeks in, then you can do an assessment and they can not only know themselves, you can know them a little bit better too.
Thank you for being an inspiration, not just to me, but to many, many other people. And the last question we always ask people is, what does the world need now? You know, in the 60s, there was the song, What the World Needs Now. And right. So what does the world need, Jamie?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, we need vaccine, right? Like that's the first thing that we need. But I think what we need is, let's put ourselves in different people's shoes and see the world from their perspective. I think one of the most interesting things about that social dilemma, because there's a lot of things I agreed with. Like, for example, I've been even when I worked at Google, I've always been pro regulation of technology companies. I think anyone who has that kind of power needs to be regulated, whether it's a telephone company, a television company, or an internet company. If they can literally change the destiny of a country, then they should be regulated, right? So I believe that strongly. But one of the other points in what we saw there was that we've gotten to the point where your news feed, if you're getting your news from Facebook, for example, everything that you're seeing makes sense to you, but you're not seeing other people's perspectives, right? And so you're like, why do those people believe that? They're crazy. When you're like, look at all these things I read. They're not reading those things, right? And so it's important to have other people's perspective and point of view and try to look at the world from the way they look at the world. And I think that would help a lot. And with that, I think what the world needs, especially from an education perspective, is I think we all need to take a step back and really think about whether we are teaching our students to be good digital citizens, right? If we're really teaching them the skills that they need to thrive on the internet. And that goes for everything from how to search. Most people are terrible searchers, and Google is actually trying to make it as easy as possible. But, you know, the technology way of searching is different than, you know, typing a question in a search box, right? So teaching students how to use the internet. There's a Stanford study from 2019 that worried me. A couple of different studies worried me, but this study said that 80% of high school kids that they studied couldn't pull out the fake story out of four stories presented to them, right? That's dangerous. Like those kids are going to come work for my company someday, and I want them to be able to know the difference between a real resource and a bad resource, right? And so taking a step back and helping students identify all the skills that they need to be good digital citizens and to take advantage of the internet. And we've, as all of us talk about this, right? Not have a generation of scrollers, but instead have a generation of creators and building things. And so I think, you know, from an education perspective, that's something across the board from kindergarten to high school, there should be a digital lead, what I call being a digital leader, curriculum across the board. That we shouldn't stop teaching students how to do that better.
Yeah, love that. That's a great answer. And that goes back to you talking about the educational system's not broke. It's doing what it's supposed to, but we're moving forward, and we gotta take our kids with us as we do that.
Yeah, we need to do is what our forefathers in education did and ask ourselves, what's the right system for the future? And use the best ideas that we have and use the best research that we know what good learning looks like, right? We know what, you know what it looks like. So why are we handing ninth graders a 3-chapter test that we know they're going to forget in 3 months anyway?
Right. Yeah,
like we're wasting time. Like we can do a lot more with that time. So this idea that there's no time to introduce different things, I think, you know, one of the things that educators can do from the district superintendent level all the way down is I used to do this with my time at Accenture, is do a start, stop, and continue exercise, right? Like what are the things that we need to start doing? And in order to do those things, what are the things that we can stop doing? And what are the things that we need to continue doing? And just a simple exercise like that at a high level helps you get started to identify places where you can stop doing things and start adding some new things in that place.
Better things. I love it.
Jamie, before we let you go, I gotta ask one more thing since you were at Google. We, in our class, we do Genius Hour. I got to know what it looks like at Google, because from what I've been told, it comes from Google's 20% project. Mm-hmm. I got to know what that looks like at Google.
Yeah, that used to be a real thing. I think it's got it embedded into just the culture, and I'm glad it is. And really, it wasn't really, there's an internal function at Google called Area 120. And this is understanding, it's for people who at Google that want to do startups, right? They want to start companies. And so Google says, pitches the idea, here's 6 months, try to get it started. Mm-hmm. At least you stay at Google while you do it. And we call it Area 120. They called it, I still feel like I worked there. They called it Area 120 because the understanding was that it wasn't a 20% project. It was your real job plus something else. Mm. Right. And so I think the philosophy behind it is you should be working on something that has nothing to do with what you do, right? Like something completely different. And that philosophy works. So for me, I'm doing work in the education space, and I like my photography, and I'm technically a professional photographer because I sold pictures, or I like my YouTube channel, right? Like getting good at something else that you do, or working on something that's different from your day-to-day job. And that's where that philosophy came from. And so I think it's an important element to not get caught up in the details of what you do, but push yourself in different areas to try to solve problems. And eventually you'll be able to solve problems in your own area because of what you discovered. Like on Friday, I'm on my way to Costa Rica. Mostly, my wife is a triathlete, and she has a company called Finding Endurance that teaches people, you know, how to be a long endurance athlete. And her partner, for one of their projects, are going down to Costa Rica to ride their bikes up volcanoes because they want to start a camp for people that are interested in doing that. So they're going out to map out the whole thing. And I'm going, and I said, hey, I'll come and shoot video and photographs of what you guys are doing so that, you know, you guys can create some interesting marketing material. I don't know how to do that. I'm going to go do it. And see what it looks like. And I think that's the culture behind this 20% project is find something that you're not good at or find something that you want to learn or do better at and then go do that. Spend some time doing that.
I like that explanation of it. And I can't wait. I can't wait till we get to the next time that we do that and I can show my kids this part of our interview.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to, you know, push yourself, and I think it's important to get out of your comfort zone. And I think that was the philosophy behind the 20% project. And it's true. Like Gmail came from a 20% project, right? Google News came from a 20% project. And there's a whole bunch of that I forgot, but these were, you know, engineers that were working on systems that said, my email sucks. Let me build a different email system while I'm doing these other things as well.
You're amazing. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Again.
All right. Thank you guys.
All right.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our show. Thanks for tuning in this week. Hopefully you're ready for another week of changing lives. We're so thankful and appreciative that you took time to listen to our guest, Jamie Cassip.
We hope that as you head out, you remember that the biggest factor that plays into student success is you. Your love, your passion, your empathy, your dedication is exactly what the world needs now. Thank you for all you do. Have a good one.